Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be with you. As a matter of fact, just talking a minute ago with Darren about whether we made the matches yesterday, and he said we made matches both hours. It took us a little while after the top of the second hour to make the matches. So I just wanted to say thanks to everybody who helped us make it through and do what I think was just a very, very fine pledge drive. People were very generous to us. So thank you for your generosity. Thanks for supporting Catholic Answers. And as promised, we won't come to you again for months to ask you for funds. As we like to say, we only do it four times a year and only for 6 hours, and even then we try not to use the whole hour. So I do want to say thank you, though. When we get through one of those, it is extremely gratifying how generous people are. We try to be very, very conservative in the spending of money, but we think we get a big bang for your buck, and we're grateful that you were that you shared it with us. Thank you very much for that. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, second hour guest, Jimmy Akin. So you can ask him anything. Ask him whatever you want. Yeah, I've been talking for like 30 seconds. Already 4 out of the 6 lines are full, and I haven't even given out the phone number yet. I think people look on the calendar. They know when Jimmy's going to be here. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of books, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Jimmy Akin, thank you for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Cy Kellett. Happy to be back.
Yeah, thanks for doing the pledge drive with us as well. I very much appreciated your contribution to that effort.
Yeah, no problem. And it's something that needs to be done. And so we try to keep it to a minimum, but we get it done.
And we got the job done. Jimmy's also the patron, or not the patron, that's the wrong word. He's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular corners of the podcasting world. And it's Friday. What dropped today, Jimmy? What dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
So one of the things that I've talked about periodically on Mysterious World is psychic functioning. And this is something that I've talked about from multiple perspectives. Like I've talked about how St. Thomas Aquinas, Pope St. Gregory the Great, among other doctors of the church, believed in psychic functioning. For example, St. Thomas Aquinas referred to what we would call precognition as natural prophecy to distinguish it from the supernatural prophecy that God gives. I've also talked to modern people, like members who were part of the Defense Department's Stargate program, about their activities using psychic functioning to try to spy out the secrets of America's enemies and so forth. But one thing that I thought I'd do this time, because it's one thing to say, well, hey, look, these famous people believed in psychic functioning, like Aquinas and Gregory the Great. And it's another thing to talk about, to talk to modern people and say, well, what happened to you? What were your experiences? But if you want to be scientific about things, you need to go beyond just experience reports and opinion. You want to do actual scientific research on a question. And so on today's Mysterious World, I report on a series of experiments that were published by a psychologist named Daryl Bim in the year 2011 in a paper called Feeling the Future, where he did a set of 9 experiments over a 10-year period. He did a set of 9 experiments that were meant to test, does precognition exist? Can ordinary people, without even realizing it, sense what's coming in the future? And he got in his experiments odds of trillions to one that they can. And this caused a major scientific controversy. But Bim was prepared for that. He wanted other people to test his methodology, which he kept deliberately simple. And he made his experiments available as part of a computer package that anybody could run anywhere in the world. And within just a couple, 3 years, numerous other researchers, including skeptics, had replicated his results. And it caused a major controversy in science, with some people saying science is broken and Daryl Bim has shown us how, because they just couldn't accept the results.
Wow. So it's, the science is broken. It's not that it's not that he pointed to something you didn't expect. It's that it's broken. All right. Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You can check it out at mysterious.fm. Of course, you can go to Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel, which you should go to. Lots and lots of great material there. Or get it wherever you get your podcasts. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Now up to 1 gazillion episodes. I'm not being exactly precise, but roughly 1 gazillion episodes.
Roughly 380. But if you round that up to a gazillion, it's okay with me.
I was rounding that off to a gazillion. Mm-hmm. All right. It's Ask Me Anything. You can ask Jimmy anything you want. Sometimes I get to ask a question, so I'm going to ask this one because we got a big Marian feast this month. I want to ask about Marian apparitions. And so here's what I've got for you, Jimmy. All the Marian apparitions that we know of, which one has the best evidence behind it?
I would say there are two plausible candidates, and which one you pick is going to depend on the criteria that you use when you say best evidence. The first one that'll be more familiar to most people is Our Lady of Fatima, where Our Lady reportedly appeared to three shepherd children in 1917 in Portugal. And this was a monthly event. It went on for about 6 months, and Mary promised that at her last appearance, she would give some kind of miraculous sign that other people would be able to perceive, and that was reported. At her final appearance, many people saw the sun behave strangely in the sky, and this is called the miracle of the sun. And about 70,000 people, including some non-believers, reported seeing the miracle of the sun. So that's pretty significant evidence. You get 70,000 people to agree on something. That's quite noteworthy. In addition to that, Mary had given some predictions to the three children. And one of them, there is no doubt that it was recorded before its fulfillment. The fulfillment of the so-called third secret, or really the third part of the secret of Fatima, did not happen until 1981. And Sister Lucia, the seer who reported the secret, had written it down years before that. And it involved, among other things, an assassination attempt on the Pope. And that happened in 1981 when Mehmet Ali Agca tried to assassinate John Paul II. And so I think we have significant evidence there. There also were other predictions that were associated with Our Lady of Fatima, such as about World War I and how it was going to end, but then a worse war, namely World War II, would break out if people didn't repent, and various other predictions. But these are found in Sister Lucia's memoirs of the event, and even though she reports receiving these predictions before they were fulfilled, the memoirs that contain the reports were actually written after those early predictions had been fulfilled. So the evidence is not as compelling in terms of fulfilled predictions as if we had them documented and on record before the fulfillments. Mm-hmm. So a skeptic could come along and say, well, she knew what had happened and she either let that color her memory or even that she just faked those predictions. Now, that won't explain the papal assassination attempt, but it could explain the others. And so I would say that it doesn't invalidate those predictions, but I would say that it requires giving credence to something that you wouldn't have to just give credence to if it had been on record clearly before the fulfillments happened. So I'm not saying she didn't get those predictions. I think she did. It's just you can't prove it to a skeptic as well. So that leads to the other candidate that I would propose for best supported apparition, and that is Our Lady of Zaytoun. Zaytoun is one of the suburbs of Cairo, Egypt, and between 1968 and 1971, the Virgin Mary appeared repeatedly at St. Mary's Coptic Parish in Zaytoun. The apparition was first noted actually by a group of Muslims who saw a woman on top of St. Mary's Parish, and they thought she was maybe going to commit suicide, maybe jump off the roof. And they intervened, and other people noticed what was happening. And this was the first of a set of appearances that lasted basically for a 3 or 4 year period. That were seen by many, many people, by Coptic Christians, by Catholic Christians, by Orthodox Christians, by Muslims, by non-believers, by Protestant Christians. Loads of people saw Our Lady of Zaytoun. On some occasions, it was estimated that as many as 250,000 or a quarter of a million people witnessed the apparitions at once. And over the course of the 3 years, it's estimated that more than a million people saw the apparitions. So that's larger in numbers than the people who saw the miracle of the sun. Also, many of these people had cameras and they took photographs of the events. The authorities also got involved in testing these apparitions. Like, they thought, well, okay, we've got this glowing figure up on top of St. Mary's Parish. Could it be generated by some kind of electrical equipment, you know, shining lights up there? So they cut off the power to the entire block, and yet the glowing phenomena remained. They also did physical inspections. They couldn't find anything causing these, so they're very well documented. What Zaytoun does not have that Fatima does is a set of predictions, at least one of which is known to have been on record before it was fulfilled. So Zaytoun has photographic evidence that is better than Fatima. It also has more witnesses than Fatima, but Fatima has a record of at least one major fulfilled prediction that is known to have been on record before the prediction was fulfilled. So I would say those are the two best supported Marian apparitions in terms of the evidence for them that you could, you know, present to a skeptic and say, well, how would you explain this? You know, they tried to explain it this way, that didn't work. They tried to explain it this other way, that didn't work. So how would you explain it if you don't accept it as a Marian apparition? One of the things you'll notice about both of those is they both occurred in the 20th century. And that's a reflection of the fact that we have better evidence capturing tools today than we did in the past, like all those photos and videos that were taken of Zaytoun. And there were even some photos and so forth taken of Our Lady of Fatima. There were also reporters, including skeptical reporters at Fatima, that were able to document things. So because these occurred very recently, there was an opportunity to gather evidence and larger quantities of evidence than for apparitions reported in the past. So I would expect that pattern to continue in the future, because our evidence gathering capabilities are so much better today than they were in the past, and so much information from the past has been lost anyway. I would expect that both now and in the future, the best documented Marian apparitions are probably going to be among the more recent ones.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. Thanks very much for indulging me. Let me ask a question at the beginning. We've got all lines full, so we will take a very quick break and be right back to let other folks ask their questions. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. What a nice summer Friday it is. Jimmy Akin here with us and lots of folks on the lines. That's a recipe for fun. It's Ask Me Anything today on Catholic Answers Live. We'll start right out here in California. Christopher is up in Salinas, California, watching on YouTube. Christopher, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. Yes, my question is about Pope Leo the 14th. As mm-hmm. you know, he is the Bishop of Rome. I know the church teaches that. Yeah, right. The question I'm making is, the church teaches that the Bishop of Rome has the full authority to make doctrinal changes in the church through the magisterium of the Catholic Church. Do you see Pope Leo the 14th making changes on the doctrine teachings in the near future? Because I know in the Catechism there's been some changes with Pope Francis and other popes. I was wondering if that's a possibility that could happen. And I know there are many Protestants that argue that the Bishop of Rome does not have the power, but the church teaches yes. I hope you can explain this question.
Okay. Well, first thing I'd say is that many Catholics would not put it in terms of changes. Change can imply, to some ears, a kind of reversal or rejection of previous teaching. And so many Catholics, rather than use the term change, they use the word development. They talk about doctrine developing rather than changing, which they see as a kind of better term, in their opinion, because saying something develops is less radical sounding than saying it changes, and it implies more continuity than reversal or rejection. Having said that, you know, I don't have a problem saying change personally, because even a development is a change. But because of the connotations that change can have for people, it's more typical to describe it as development rather than change. I don't think there's a substantive difference here, but I recognize the term change can sometimes have connotations that would be misleading, and so I understand why people may want to avoid that term. But I wouldn't say you're being wrong in how you express it. I would just say that many people would express it differently. In terms of will Pope Leo make changes or have developments under his tenure in Catholic doctrine, I would say, I would expect that. That's normal for popes. Now, normally or frequently, they don't make those changes themselves. What they will do instead is they have what's now called the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith over in Rome. And periodically, the Dicastery will release a doctrinal instruction on some topic where they summarize previous teaching and they cover a few new elements. And this has been happening frequently in recent years, among other reasons, because of all the biomedical and technological abilities that humans have generated in the last 100 years. And so there are now new possibilities for what you can do with medicine and technology that could never have been done before. Like, for example, the idea of in vitro fertilization. That's something that was not possible before the mid 20th century. And so because of these new possibilities opening up, there's a need to apply Catholic principles to them. And this expands or develops Catholic teaching into new areas. Well, I would expect that Pope Leo is going to do what previous popes have done when the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, or now the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, proposes a new doctrinal instruction, what they do before they issue it is they bring it to the Pope and they say, do you agree with this? And if the Pope approves it, it becomes part of the Pope's own personal magisterium. Even though he's not the body that wrote the document, that was the Dicastery, he's the one that approved it. And so it becomes part of his personal teaching, even though he's not the author of the document. And this has been a normal thing that popes have done for ages, and certainly recent popes have approved documents of the now Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, and I expect Pope Leo will do the same thing going forward, and at least some of those documents, not all of them, but some of them will propose new elements or new understandings of individual parts of Catholic teaching. Popes also can themselves author documents where they make similar developments, although, and that does happen with some regularity, but it's not as common as using the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. But I would expect Pope Leo may well do that as well. So, yeah, I think Pope Leo is going to do what popes normally do, which usually involves some kind of development, either made through their own personal teaching ministry or through the approval of the teaching ministry of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. Will any of those end up in the Catechism? Well, that I don't know. It might if Pope Leo wants it to, but the Catechism primarily deals with fundamental Christian questions, and so it's not as likely that you're going to see notable developments on those subjects. It's more likely you're going to see notable developments on things that the Church has not historically addressed in a great deal of detail. Like, for example, one of the things that Pope Leo has already mentioned that he's concerned about is artificial intelligence. And so I would expect that during his tenure as Pope, we may have some new teaching regarding artificial intelligence and how Catholics and other people should regard it. We've already had a document on that subject that came out late in the tenure of Pope Francis, but because it's a particular issue of Pope Leo, we may get some action and development on that subject as well during his tenure. But will he make any modifications in the Catechism? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, the Catechism was only issued in the tenure of John Paul II, so you can't really count him. And then after him, we've only had two popes, Benedict, who did not make any changes in the Catechism, and Francis, who did. So judging by the historical record, it's kind of 50-50. Will Pope Leo make any changes in the Catechism or not?
Christopher, thank you very much. Appreciate the question. Appreciate you getting us started today with your call. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. I'm going to try to get another question in before we have to take another break. Colin is in Newfoundland, Canada, listening on our website, Catholic.com. Welcome back, Colin.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Speaking of feeling the future, suppose I were to meet a time-traveling Catholic priest from the future, and he tells me about things the Magisterium has solemnly defined as dogma in his past but my future. Would I be bound to holding those truths at the level of assent due to a dogma now in my present?
Okay. My first question is, why a time-traveling Catholic priest? Why not a time-traveling Jimmy Akin? You know,
we've already got that.
Yeah. I'm not allowed to talk about that.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
The real issue here. Okay. So I have to begin with a disclaimer that the Church does not have a doctrine on this because it doesn't have any documents dealing with time travel. So what I have to do in order to answer a question like this is look at the underlying principles. Now, in principle, Catholics are bound to what the Magisterium has defined thus far. But Catholics are also bound to what they know to be true. And by no, I mean in the full sense, 100%, you know this, there is no doubt about it. So I would say that if a time traveler of whatever nature appeared to you and told you about a doctrinal development in the future that the Church has infallibly ruled on in the future, then your obligation to believe what you're told would depend on the degree of confidence you have that what the time traveler is telling you is accurate. If the time traveler seems to have a good grasp of the facts and what he says is plausible, you'd have a greater degree than if the time of confidence than if the time traveler seems less sure of the facts or doesn't seem to be that to have great a great command of the facts. So what he's saying might not be reliable. Hypothetically, it would be possible for a person to achieve complete certitude that what the time traveler is saying is correct. But that's the real question, is how much trust do you have in what the time traveler says? It really doesn't matter where the source of the confidence comes from. If you are certain that something is true, regardless of how you became certain, then it would that would be something you would be obliged to believe. But in most time travel scenarios, you're not necessarily going to have full confidence, among other reasons, because maybe this time traveler is from a possible future, not an actual future. And in the actual future, maybe the magisterium never defines this. So that right there could be a reason to not have full confidence in what the time traveler declares.
Colin, you always have a good question. Thank you very much. The time traveler could be from the past and just stole a time machine from a different time travel that came from the future. It could all get mixed up like that. You never know. Be careful with time travelers. Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. A little bit of groovy music for you there. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy Akin is one of the featured speakers at this year's Catholic Answers Conference. We'd love it if you'd come. September 25th through the 28th, we got a wonderful lineup of speakers. And the topic is about sharing the faith with others. Krista Fanick is giving our keynote address. Dr. David Anders would be there. And I will tell you right now, I'd come just to hear Dr. David Anders to the whole conference. But our good friend, Dr. Amy Hamilton, someone we have come to admire here, she'll be there. Steve Dawson, the founder of St. Paul Street Evangelization, will be there. And all of our apologists. We'll do the radio show. We just love it if you'd come and hang out with us. Just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com and book your tickets now. $50 off each ticket if you use the promo code EARLY. Use the promo code EARLY at CatholicAnswersConference.com. Back to the phones we go. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it is Ask Me Anything. Let's see what Daniel in Española, New Mexico. Did I get it right? Española, New Mexico, Daniel?
Yeah. You got it right last time also.
Oh, do I say that every time you call?
This is only the second time.
Okay.
Last time was,
you could count on it the third time now, Daniel.
Hey, it's great to be on with Jimmy because the Mysterious Akin podcast is what led me to my first OCIA class, which I took 2 days ago. So,
wow.
I'm going to keep it short like you guys like it. Is sedevacantism heresy?
No. Sedevacantism, at least considered by itself, is not heresy. Classically, the church has spoken, and there's actually more than this, but classically the church has spoken of three canonical crimes against the faith, which are known as apostasy, heresy, and schism. And apostasy is the total abandonment of the Christian faith. So a person who's an apostate would say, yeah, I'm not a Christian anymore. If they maintain any kind of Christian identity, then they are not an apostate. So sedevacantists who think that there is no current pope, they would say, well, but I'm still a Christian. Even though I don't think there is a pope right now, I do think there is still a Christian. So they're not an apostate. Heresy is the post-baptismal doubt or denial, basically a refusal to believe some dogma of the faith, something that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. And a sedevacantist may say, well, I don't think there's a current pope, but I believe everything the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. So I'm not a heretic, and they'd be right. Now, that's not to say that other sedevacantists might not hold to heresies. Some might, but it's not intrinsic to sedevacantism itself. One thing that is commonly associated with sedevacantism is a misunderstanding of what actually is a heresy, because many of the sedevacantist arguments will accuse, they have the idea that a pope who is a heretic cannot be a valid pope, and then they, which is itself debatable, and then they accuse recent popes of teaching heresy, and invariably, when you look at what they're claiming, either the recent popes haven't taught it, or it's not actually a heresy. So they have a tendency to over-identify heresy. They have lots of false positives when it comes to heresy. But having a false positive is not the same on what counts as heresy is not the same thing as being a heretic yourself. And sedevacantism does not involve of itself any heresy. Then there's the third crime against the faith, which is schism. And schism is one of two things. Schism is either the refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff, meaning the current valid pope, or it's the refusal of communion with those who have communion with the current valid pope. And that is something that sedevacantists are guilty of. By saying there's not a current pope, someone with papal authority, when in fact there is, that means that they are not in submission to the Roman pontiff. So on that ground, sedevacantists are schismatic. They also commonly are schismatic on the second ground, because they will commonly refuse communion. And this is not, again, not necessarily all of them would make this a conscious refusal of communion with those who are in communion with the true pope, but many of them do. They'll talk about, oh, this new church or this new Vatican II church, and they'll say it's a false church, and they thereby refuse communion with those who are in communion with the Roman pontiff. And so at least on the grounds of saying there's not a current pope when there is, and frequently on the ground of refusing communion with those who are in communion with the Roman pontiff, Sedevacantists are schismatics on those grounds. So they do commit one of the three classical crimes against the faith. It is not apostasy, because they don't deny the whole thing. It's not heresy, because merely rejecting the idea there's a current pope does not entail a rejection of a dogma of the church. But they do commit schism, which is of itself a mortal sin. And so by embracing Sedevacantism, they are endangering their souls.
Okay, that was great.
All right, very good. Well, congratulations on starting the OCIA process. I think that the reason I'm insecure about saying Española is our document doesn't have an ñ on it, so I wasn't sure. So that's,
oh, yeah.
That's
what I was every thinking. Time I call it into Española. I'm like, yeah, there sometimes is an ñ, but depending on who spells it.
Yeah.
Thank you guys very much.
All right, thank you. Well, I'm going to try to get it right the next time.
Also, you always got to take into account how the locals pronounce it, like, you know, right. Palestine, Texas, instead of Palestine, Texas.
Right, exactly. And or I'll forget the name of the town here. There's a name of a town here in California where if you're from the north of California, you pronounce it one way. And if you're from the south, you pronounce it another way. And I can't remember. Paso Robles. Yeah, it's Paso Robles if you're from the north. Yes, it is. Yes, north of where you're from. But you pronounce it with the Spanish pronunciation if you come from Southern California.
Yeah, here in Arkansas, we have Lavaca, pronounced in Arkansas, Lavaca. But it's not pronounced the Spanish way, Lavaca or the cow.
Yeah, yeah.
But in New Mexico, it wouldn't at all surprise me for the locals to say Española rather than Espanola.
It doesn't seem like Espanola would be right in New Mexico. No.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Long Island then. I hope it's – is it long? Is there an ñ in Long Island or is it just an N? Edgar? I can't tell. Gil in Long Island. Welcome,
yeah,
Gil.
Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
Actually, you're pronouncing it as if it's an ñ.
I was trying to fit an ñ in there, but I
can't. That's what's known as, in Greek, it's called a gamma nasal, but it's a nasalization of the ñ sound, which we do automatically in English before a G. So it's Long Island rather than Long Island. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for
Long
calling.
Long Island, so I say. Yes. Thank you very much for letting me call. I know that we must trust Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. And in Revelation 3:20, it says, "Here I am, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come and eat with him and he with me." Now, in light of that, can we receive Jesus Christ by personal invitation rather than the sacraments? Because I used to, like when I used to ride the trains years back, a lot of times I would share the gospel with people. And I would share the Romans Road with them and all of that stuff. I'm sure you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
I would hold their hand and ask them to receive Jesus and pray with me. Can a person still receive Jesus by personal invitation rather than just the sacraments?
Okay, so what did Jesus say about eating his flesh and drinking his blood? Did he say that was optional for Christians or non-optional?
Right, non-optional.
Yeah, okay. What did he say about getting baptized? Was that optional for Christians or non-optional?
Non-optional. We must be baptized in Acts 2:38.
So what does Jesus want for his followers? Does he want them to merely accept him in some spiritual way, or does he want them to also receive the sacraments?
Right.
Well, which is it? Tell me the answer.
Both.
Okay, right. So it's not Jesus's will for his followers just to accept him in some spiritual sense. And he wants them to go on to receive the sacrament. So the Romans Road is problematic for multiple reasons, including the fact that it totally leaves out the church and the sacraments. So that's a separate question than if someone doesn't know any better, could they accept Jesus in a purely spiritual way and still go to heaven? Let's see what you say on that, Gil. If someone didn't know any better through no fault of their own, and they tried to receive Jesus in a purely spiritual way without the sacraments, do you think God would let him into heaven, or do you think God would send him to hell?
God would send him to heaven.
Okay, so the Catholic Church would agree with that. If someone's not a Catholic or doesn't receive the sacraments through no fault of their own, then they can still be saved. But that's not what Jesus wants for his followers. He wants them to have more than that. So it seems to me, Gil, that you already knew the answer to this, and you didn't need me to tell it to you.
Oh, I just love calling, you know. Jesus is the rock, and I'm ready to roll, so I love to ask questions.
Well, thank you, Gil. It's always nice to talk with you. Thank you very much. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more from all around the country. Towns with N-Y-A-S in their title, towns without N-Y-A-S in their title. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. There are two lines open right now, 888-318-7884.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, has asked me anything. And if I say there's a line open, they just fill right up. So lines are full at the moment. And so back to those callers we will go. Billy is in College Station, Texas, listening on 1330 AM. Glad to have you, Billy. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Jimmy. First of all, thank you for your work. It's noble and sacred and worthwhile, and we all appreciate it. But just to give you a quick preface, so for my question, you looked at the establishment of the early church throughout the Acts of the Apostles and even into the first three centuries, and it seems like at that time frame, God's providence, his power and protection is clearly front and center stage against protecting the church from both heresy and corruption. And then you get into this era of around 900 AD where there's not just sin, but sin on a reprehensible and systemic level. And so my question is, you know, you read the book of Acts and this is the church, you're convinced this is the church the gates of hell cannot prevail against. And then you read about the occurrences in 900 AD and you begin to question God's protection and his providence over the church. And so my question is, how do you reconcile that as a believer, and how do you make sense of that?
Okay, well, I would make sense of it or reconcile it by noting a few different things. The first one is the book of Acts is one selection of data about the church. But it's not a complete picture of the church, even in the first century. Luke is writing to help Theophilus and other people appreciate Christianity and the church in the book of Acts. So he's not going to go into like scandals in the church unless he has to. And for the most part, he doesn't have to. So he doesn't include those because they're not part of his purpose for writing. On the other hand, if you look at St. Paul's letters, particularly 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and also Galatians, he talks about more scandals in the church because he has a different purpose in writing. He's writing to people to help them through difficult situations in the church. And so that forces Paul to go into scandalous material in a way that Luke is not required to, because they just have different purposes in writing. So in building a picture of what was the church like in the first century, I wouldn't confine myself to just looking at the book of Acts and saying, hey, it all looks great here. There's other data that indicates there were problems in the early church, some of them of a scandalous nature. So that's part of how I would reconcile this. Then in looking at events later in church history, like you mentioned, the 9th century, which would be the AD 800s, I'd even go a little bit later than that if you want to find the biggest scandals in church history. But you can point to popes like, let's say, Benedict the 9th and say, wow, what a rascal this guy was. He was clearly scandalous, but he's also not the whole church. This is kind of the reverse problem of just focusing on Acts, which makes the church look good. If you focus just on the scoundrels who were popes, well, then you're just focusing on the data that makes the church look bad. You're not looking at the innumerable number of Christians who were very pious and sincere in their faith in later ages. So it's really comparing apples to oranges if you do this kind of thing. What I would say one needs to do in conducting this kind of analysis is look at the good and the bad in every age. And there is good and bad in every age. So, you know, I would say we have evidence for problems in the church in the first century. We also have evidence for great things in the church in the first century. We have providence. We have problems in the church in later ages. We have great things in the church in later ages. But what God promised was not that we would have a problem-free experience of the church. He promised that he would provide guidance to the church such that the gates of hell would not prevail against it, meaning that the gates of hell is a reference to death. That's what the gates of hell is. If you look in Isaiah, for example, or in other passages in the Old Testament, it talks about the gates of Hades or hell being where people go when they die. So when Jesus says the gates of hell are not going to prevail against his church, or the gates of Hades are not going to prevail against his church, what he means is church is never going to die. It's never, and that means, among other things, it's never going to fundamentally betray the Christian faith. That's not to say that an individual pope may not, or that an individual set of bishops may not, or that individual members of the faithful may not, but there's not going to be a total repudiation of the Christian faith. It's going to continue to survive in the form of the church. And when you consider it that way, well, that's what we see looking down through all 20 centuries of church history. There have been problems in every age. There have been great things in every age, but the church has never had the gates of Hades prevail against it. It's never died. It's never totally repudiated its master and Lord Jesus Christ. So we do have evidence for God guiding the church throughout all of its history.
That's profound and beautiful. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking my call.
Billy,
no problem.
Thank you very much. It was nice talking with you. Let's go to Danny in Iowa. Danny, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to know what my obligation would be for I have my mother that will receive communion, but she is not of the Catholic faith. My mother and father both come up and they will do that. They will also take my kids to a Catholic church when they stay with them. Mm-hmm. And what's my obligation to let them know whether or not they should be receiving that?
Well, the first thing is to determine whether or not they should be receiving, because there are situations in which non-Catholics can receive communion in a Catholic church. So the first question, the first threshold to clear is, are they baptized?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
They were married in the church as well, and I was actually raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But they have gone away from the Catholicism and are, I think, more Protestant now.
Okay. It relates to my next question, which is, are either or both of them members of an Eastern church, like Eastern Orthodoxy or Oriental Orthodox? And it's, I'm guessing the answer based on what you just said is no, but I want to verify that.
Yep, I'll say no.
Okay. So have they formally repudiated the Catholic Church by joining a Protestant church?
I guess I don't know what that would mean by that they are at a Protestant church now, but they haven't formally done anything to separate themselves from the Catholic Church, if that makes sense.
Okay. Well, if they're just going to a Protestant church and they're not going to a Catholic church, then they could still canonically be considered Catholics, even though they would need to, unless sort of the next hurdle, if they're considered Catholics legally, would be, have they fulfilled their Easter duty, meaning at least once a year, typically during Easter, but not always during Easter, have they been going to confession?
No.
Okay. So under those circumstances, if you consider them Catholic, if they are to be legally considered Catholic, well, then they shouldn't be going without going to confession. And it would be a good thing to say, hey, I appreciate that you're receiving the Eucharist. I really appreciate you taking our kids to Catholic Mass. That's really great. Just want to remind you that, you know, if you haven't been to confession in a while, you need to go. And I'd be happy to do whatever I can to help you in that process. Now, that depends. Whether you have an obligation to tell them that is going to depend on your relationship with them. It sounds like you may have a fairly positive relationship with them, in which case, otherwise they wouldn't be taking your kids to a Catholic Mass. But, and if you have a positive obligation, giving them some kind of helpful reminder of what they need to do as Catholics would be beneficial. On the other hand, if you had a really hostile relationship with them, and bringing this fact up would push them away from Jesus and his church, then it could be reasonable to not further distance them from Jesus and his church, but to try to attract them back to Jesus and his church in some other way. It's true that they would be receiving Jesus in a state where they shouldn't receive him in the interim, but Jesus himself voluntarily chose to make himself vulnerable in that way. And there are situations where, let's say, a priest even knows that a person is receiving when they shouldn't, but they're required to let them have communion anyway. You know, like, let's say a priest knows that a person did not get absolved of a mortal sin during their last confession. Because the priest knows that from the sacrament of confession, he's not allowed to use that to hurt them in any way. So he can't say to them, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to give you communion, because the person's sin is not public. And so consequently, the priest himself has to give communion legally to a person he knows is not qualified to receive it. And Jesus chose to make himself vulnerable in that way. So there are similar situations where, even though the good thing is to have a relationship with one's parents or whomever, such that you can say, hey, by the way, here's what you need to do if you want to go to communion, it's understood that's not always possible in a concrete situation. And so you have to make a judgment call about your parents and how they're going to react and so forth like that. If they come back and they say, well, I don't really consider myself Catholic anymore, I think of myself as a Protestant now, well, that's okay. I mean, it's not the ideal, but there are situations in which a Protestant can receive communion in a Catholic church, provided that there is some grave need for it and they share the church's faith in the sacraments. And, you know, they also still would need to go to confession if they have any mortal sins they need to confess. So the situation's more complicated, But again, it goes back to what's your relationship with your parents and how are they going to react to this? Will it draw them closer to Christ and his church and help facilitate a reconciliation with the church, or will it push them farther away from the church? So that's the real issue that needs to be decided. And you know the answers to those questions better than I would.
I appreciate that. Conversation needs to be had, and that's what I'll do.
Okay. And if you need further resources for all that, there is a statement from the U.S. bishops that's printed at the back of Ordinary Missals that may help you out in finding the language to use. And you can even show it to them and say, here's what the U.S. bishops have had to say.
Danny, I would like to send you a little book called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, a book by Jimmy Akin. I think you will find comfort and help in that book. If you just hang on.
Give it to your parents.
It's one that you could. Well, let's give them two. Let's give them two copies of that book, Words of Eternal Life. Danny, hang on and give us an address and we will send those out to you. We have to take a very quick break. We will continue with Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin after the break. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. We're coming right back. And if you haven't called yet and you'd like to get on the line, everybody's welcome. It's Catholic Answers Live, but you don't have to be Catholic to call. 888-318-7884.